Hello everyone, and welcome to CrumSearch, clinical research appraisal and methodology for surgical trainees, where we pick a paper fresh from the press on a hot general surgical topic. We review it for you, we present it for you, we critique its methodology for you, and provide top-of-the-field expert opinion and teaching on research appraisal and methodology. My name is Gio Perrin, and together with Professor Sababala Subramanian and Maria Digby, we bring you CrumSearch from the wonderful region of the Yorkshire and the Humber.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we're going to talk about another abdominal wall paper looking at laparoscopic versus robotic ventral hernia repair. Following that, I'll be giving a short lecture on Pearson's correlation coefficient and how to do it in Jamovi. I'll leave you to it.
My name is Pratik. I'm one of the ST4s working in Rotherham currently, and I will be presenting this paper with Gia, which is titled A Retrospective Study Comparing the Operative Outcomes of Extraperitoneal Retrorectus Access Laparoscopic and Robotic Assisted Ventral Hernia Repairs. And this paper's come out in the World Journal of Surgery, April 2025. And it comes out from India by Bindal et al. So between me and Gia, we'll present this paper. So Gia, will you take it away with the methodology and the results?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you, Pratik. So my name is Gia. I'm one of the F2s based in Grimsby. So I'll be starting with the aim. So the study aimed to compare the operative and post-operative outcomes between robotic-assisted and laparoscopic ETAP. So ETAP is short for Enhanced View Totally Extraperitoneal Repair, and we're looking at ventral hernias in this study. Next slide, please. So if we were to put it into a PICO format, P is population, and in this study, it's adult patients undergoing retrorectus ventral hernia repair. I is intervention, which is robotic-assisted approach. And C is what we're comparing with, which is laparoscopic approach. And O is the outcome. And we'll be looking at the operative time, length of hospital stay, post-op complications, and readmissions. So for methods, this is a retrospective chart review conducted on 120 consecutive patients undergoing ETAP with or without TAR. So TAR is short for transversus abdominis release, which is the use of this is determined by tension on posterior rectus sheath, which Pratik will elaborate a bit more later on. So this study is between the period of June 2021 and October 2023. Out of the 120 patients, 73 patients underwent robotic-assisted ETAP and 47 patients underwent laparoscopic ETAP. And all of these surgeries were performed by the same experienced surgeon. Next slide, please. Yeah.
So I'll tell a little bit about the surgical techniques that they've described in the paper. So for the robotic arm, they use the Da Vinci XI system with three robotic ports. So first, they use an optical port to get into the retrorectus space and make some dissection with the using the camera. And then they put two further ports on the left-hand side, and dissection is started and crossover from the left to the right by dividing across the posterior rectus sheath peritoneum complex across the midline to the other side, and then from cranial to caudally up to the space of Bogros caudally. And they place a so they repair the posterior rectus sheath, try to preserve as much of the sac peritoneum as possible, and then use it to reinforce the posterior sheath repair, and they repair it with the barbed suture. And then also they will repair the anterior sheath defect with a suture and use the subcutaneous and skin of the defect as well, and sort of put it all together into the suture. For the laparoscopic bit, the steps of the operation are similar, but they use a couple of extra ports on the right-hand side. They use a proline mesh, I believe, to repair the hernia. And yeah, that's more or less about the surgical steps that they have described. So I'll hand over to Gia again to talk a bit of the results.
So, for baseline characteristics, the two groups were broadly similar in BMI, gender, and comorbidities. The robotic group was slightly younger in age and had significantly larger hernia defects on average. And this probably suggests that more complex cases were preferentially managed robotically in this institution. So for outcomes, in the robotic surgery, it showed that there was significantly lower pain scores at 24 hours and 14 days after surgery. There were better patient well-being scores within 14 days, shorter operative times, at about 152 minutes compared to 195 minutes in laparoscopic cases. There were larger mean hernia defect size and significantly fewer post-operative complications. Okay, and the length of hospital stay and analgesic use was also, they were both comparable between the two groups. For subgroup analysis, for hernia defects that are less than 7 centimeters in size, robotic cases required no TAR. So no component separation, whereas nearly half of the laparoscopic cases did. Robotic surgery had shorter operating times and better pain and well-being scores. For defects that are about 7 to 10 centimeters in size, only 43% of the robotic cases needed component separation, whereas there were 100% in laparoscopic cases. And for defects that are bigger than 10 centimeters, only robotic repair was performed, and it also showed excellent pain and quality of life scores. All three groups did show shorter operating time in the robotic groups. For adverse events, post-operative complications were significantly higher in laparoscopic groups, and there was one readmission in laparoscopic group as well. Other key findings that we noted from this paper includes robotic repairs were performed on larger and more complex defects. Robotic group consistently had better post-operative recovery metrics, and robotic technique was also used to repair hernias that were bigger than 10 centimeters in size, where laparoscopic approach was not considered.
So I'll talk about the limitations of the paper. So they've self-reported some limitations, including the retrospective study design, lack of randomization because it's an observational study, absence of long-term follow-up, and a relatively small sample size. Reading through the paper, we think that there are some other limitations to the paper. So it's based in a single center and a single surgeon only. There was no clear criteria for deciding one or the other approach, that is robotic or laparoscopic. Reading through the paper, it seems that larger or more complex hernias get a robotic approach than the laparoscopic one. There was no cost analysis, which is a big consideration for robotic surgery versus laparoscopic surgery. There is no standardization of TAR criteria. So essentially, they report that depending on the tension on the posterior sheath, they decided if they would want to do a TAR or not. However, we can see that they have done a TAR on more laparoscopic cases than robotic cases. And for laparoscopic cases with smaller defects than robotic cases as well. So, how the tension on the posterior sheath differs for laparoscopic cases versus open, rather than patient factors or hernia size defect, we don't really get. We don't really get an insight into that. Although they have said that the robotic approach offers better maneuverability and easier access into suturing and dissection. So sort of they kind of make a point that that might be a reason, but it's not clear. Then the laparoscopic group had a greater requirement for TAR, as I already mentioned, which would influence the perioperative outcomes, that is operative times and the pain outcomes and the quality of life outcomes, because it's a more extensive operation in that arm. And more port placements as well would influence possibly the pain and quality of life outcomes. And there was no comment on conversion. They might not have to convert any of these cases, but that would have been also insightful. So in conclusion, we think that the robotic retrorectus ventral hernia repair is safe and feasible, minimally invasive approach when compared to the laparoscopic repair for ventral abdominal wall hernias in high volume robotic centers. With regards to perspective, the methodology, the good things we thought was that they described their surgical approach quite well, and it could be reproducible. The bad things about the methodology include that it is a single center, single st surgeon study, retrospective in design, which has selection bias, and it will be difficult to reproduce it, as there was no clear criteria about selection of the two approaches, and also the unavailability of the robotic platform in many centers across the world still. Talking about the clinical things, the good things that we thought was the choice of relevant outcomes between the two approaches, and that the robotic approach seems to be promising for ventral hernia repairs, in that the surgeon was able to perform more bigger hernias, more complex hernias, and potentially more technically challenging in the robotic platform, and with fewer complications and better outcomes. However, the bad things would be that it's not generalizable at this point of time, because this platform is not available widely. So that's the end of our presentation.
Brief summary of the discussion we had about the paper. We reiterated how selection bias is probably the main issue that this type of publication suffers from, and that might well justify part of the differences that were noted in the operating approach between the robotic and the laparoscopic platform. We also discussed how the authors seem to assume a normality in the data set when applying statistical tests, particularly the student's t-test. But it is might well possible that this is an editorial choice, and simply to keep the paper short, they don't talk about the possibility of the data not being normally distributed. However, given the size of the sample, which is quite small, it is difficult to think that the data would be normally distributed in all the cases of where T student's T was applied. So we flagged this up with the authors. We also discussed how it isn't clear what type of preoperative adjuncts were used in this particular paper about ventral hernia repair. For example, Botox injection or progressive pneumoperitoneum, which could significantly affect the need for adjunctus abdominis release. We also touched upon the concept of multiple statistical testing, how this could potentially generate some false positive findings. We'll write it all up for the authors, and we'll look forward to their reply. Thank you.
Let's get straight into it. So we continue our statistical tests, how to guide series of presentations. Today we're going to talk about Pearson's correlation. Usual disclaimer, not a statistician, not an expert in stat software. So feel free to ask any questions. If I don't know the answer, I will look it up and clarify. So far, we have talked about assumptions, and we talked about assumptions again and again and again because they're very important. We talked about students T, ANOVA, which ANOVA, two-way ANOVA, per sample t-test, repeated observations ANOVA, and we also looked at how to run them. Today, we are going to move forward. We are going to remain on continuous data. We're still looking at normally distributed data. And we're going to talk about the concept of correlation and what it is mathematically, as well as how to run it on Jamovi, which is our favorite software. So let's start with the person who sort of didn't necessarily create the concept of correlation, but certainly made it popular to the point that the correlation coefficient is known as Pearson's correlation. Very famous statistician. He fathered Biometrica, which used to be the most important statistical journal in the world. If you remember, that's the journal where the student's t-test was published by Mr. Gosset. He was also a mentor of Sister Florence Nightingale, that you can see in the picture there to the right at UCL. His sort of main legacy was basically creating this massive observatory of data where, for example, people would come in to register their own height and weight and the height and weight of their children. And Pearson was trying to figure out a relationship between the two. And he came up with the concept of regression to the mean, for example. So, very, very important person. Of note, he's reported in the vast majority of his papers as K. Pearson, but his original name was actually Carl Pearson with a C. He changed his initials from C to K in honor of Karl Marx. So let's go to correlation. What is correlation? Well, correlation is a measure of statistical relationship between two variables. And if you want to be boring and express it mathematically, which I feel we should do to an extent, is the ratio between the covariance of the two variables that you're looking at and product of their standard deviations. Now, we all know what standard deviation is because we talked about it in previous lectures. Let's briefly touch on covariance again without getting too boring. Covariance is a measure of how two variables change together. Or joint variability. It's basically a result of the difference between the value that you're registering and the mean of that particular distribution, and they are considered together for the two variables that you're looking at. In order to understand variance and standard deviation, I'll refer you back to chapters 13, 14, and 15 that you can find on our website, and they will give you a detailed breakdown of variables and measures of our distribution is including variance and standard deviation. So the correlation coefficient is the jump forward. So we talked about correlation as a concept. We now are talking about how to express that numerically. And basically, if you plot the two variables together, you can find out that they can be very much positively correlated or negatively correlated or not correlated at all. And there is a whole range that goes from one to minus one. And this is because, again, this is the result of a ratio. So basically, it can only range from one to minus one. The strength of the correlation is then again measured on a numerical scale. Most commonly, it is also accompanied by a p-value, which will tell you how statistically significant that correlation is. Assumptions are important here as well. We still need to check for normality. And to an extent, particularly Pearson's correlation is also sensitive to stochasticity, although not as much. There is also another very important variable to remember, which is independence. the two variables that you're looking at have to be independent from each other. So you can't run it, for example, on repeated measures. Now, if there is one thing that you need to remember from this lecture is that correlation and causation are not the same thing. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with a satirical religion called Flying Spaghetti Monsterism or Pastafarianism. It was described the first time in 2005 by a guy named Bobby Henderson when the Kansas State Board of Education decided to allow for the teaching of intelligent design, which is basically a theory whereby God has created all creatures at one point, as an alternative to evolution in schools. This quite upset Bobby, so he decided to write a letter to the Board of Education, highlighting how he thought his own theory on creation, which obviously relates to the flying spaghetti monster, should be taught in school. And as part of his religious rant, he described also a very key concept in flying spaghetti monsterism, which is the obvious causative relationship between the declining number of pirates in the world and the raising global average temperatures, which, as you can see in this chart, that demonstrate correlation. You know, it's very obvious. The pirates are disappearing, so the temperatures are going up. Obviously, it was taking the proverbial P. This is purely a matter of correlation and not a matter of causation. So it is very important to remember that correlation and causation are two very different things. Okay. And again, this is probably the only important thing that you need to remember from this. Now, as usual, let's go into an example. And let's go back to my lovely dissertation data set. If you remember, I collected data about papers that were advertised on the Twitter network by publishing journals. For the purposes of today's example, I collected data on retweets and likes. Are these two variables correlated with each other? Well, we'll soon find out because we're going to have a go now. So let's load our data set, which you will probably now remember from the previous lectures. We will find the correlation matrices under the level of regression on Jamovi for some reason. You just click on correlation matrix. You can choose which type of correlation coefficient you want to know about. For the purposes of today's example, we'll pick Pearson. Next time, maybe we'll talk about Spearman and what it means. And let's look at retweets and let's look at likes. And as you can see, there is a correlation, which is quite strong, 0.964. This is a positive correlation. So as the retweets grow, the likes seems to grow as well. There is also a statistically significant p-value. You can also ask Jamovi for a correlation matrix, and it will show you a chart with the two variables. Obviously the line in the middle. You can also choose a hypothesis, so correlation or positive correlation or negative correlation if you want. You can ask for confidence intervals. You can't check straight here for assumptions, so you will have to go on your exploration if you want to check if retweets and likes are normally distributed and go on descriptives and run your Shapiro-Wilk test, for example. Right, I think we'll call it for today.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening. Until next time, keep ramming your life with our surgical podcast.